Tokyo! Are you ready? Will you welcome epic recording artist Cheap Trick?
It's time for some cheap talk. You're listening to Trick Chat.
And with that familiar music, you are listening to your Cheap Trick podcast, Cheap Talk. I'm Ken Mills, and I'm joined by the ever wonderful BJ Cramp.
Hello.
And BJ, we have a special guest with us today. Who is this fine gentleman on the other line?
Our special guest is Mr. Steve West, the drummer from Danger Danger. Hey, Steve.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, we're starting already. All right. Hello. Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
This next one is the first song on our new album. Yes, today we're going to talk about the one, the only, Cheap Trick, live at Budokan.
Woo!
But before we do that, let's talk about Steve West. Cheap Trick story. Steve, please tell us your Cheap Trick story, how you first found out about the band, and what you think about Cheap Trick.
Well, first, I'd like to say hi, Ken and BJ, and thank you for having me. I'm very excited and honored to be part of this, and I will do my best to recollect, since it was a very, very, very long time ago. So how did I find Cheap Trick is what you're asking me, pretty much, how this all started. Well, you know, when I was a kid, like most, I think most kids my age, I'm 50 years old, so I'm not a kid anymore. I used to, you know, listen to a lot of rock and roll, and I'd get a lot of info and stuff on rock and roll and bands and things like that from all the magazines. So I had a subscription to Circus Magazine, which maybe you guys did or some of your listeners did, and back then, and Cream Magazine. And basically in Circus Magazine, I would be seeing all these ads for this band Cheap Trick, and they look kind of wacky. You know, it was like they got two really cool rock guys and two goofy-looking guys. And I'm like, I couldn't wrap my head around that. Because at the time, I liked bands where everybody looked like cool rock stars.
Right.
My favorite band was Kiss at the time, and just Aerosmith and Alice Cooper, just guys that looked really cool. So pretty much none of those bands had guys that were goofy looking. So Cheap Trick was kind of weird for me because they had Robin Zander and Tom Petersen, whose image was spot on for me, and then Rick and Bunny, which I couldn't, like I said, couldn't understand. So I kind of didn't really check them out, but I knew who they were. And then eventually something happened. I don't know what it was, but I went out and I got Heaven Tonight when it came out. And man, when I put that record on and heard Surrender, I was it. I was done. And that record is to this day my favorite record of all time. And just I was hooked from that record on. And then moving forward, like I went backwards from there. You know, I got the first album after that, and that blew my mind. And I was like, holy crap, this is insane. And that was a whole other thing, obviously, from Heaven Tonight. So it was like a whole different band. And then I think after that, then I did get In Color. And it was just, I was off to the races. And then, of course, while Heaven Tonight was happening, I had seen an ad and heard about this record that was only available in Japan called Live at Budokan. And I had to track that thing down. And at the time, it was not available in the States, as you remember, just in Japan. So I lived just outside of New York City, got in my car and tracked down some import record store in Manhattan, and I just drove there. And they had a lot of imports and stuff. I had never been to an import record store. I just used to buy my records, you know, at the department store in the neighborhood, you know, JCPenney's or Corvettes or whatever. And I went to this record store that had these all these crazy records, and I asked if they had that record, the Cheap Trick of Budokan record, and they had it. And I was so happy, man. And I got the record. I took it out of the stack of records, and two things struck me: the weight of the record. Because the Japanese vinyl was so much heavier. So it was really heavy, and it was also really expensive. It was like twice the price of a record or more. I mean, records back then were like $4.99 for an album. And I think this record was like $10 or $12. It was like blowing my mind. I was like, what? And I was a kid, you know, and I didn't have that kind of money. But I just plunked it down and grabbed the record, went home, put it on, and again, my mind was blown. And again, but I remember the record, just the record being just so heavy. The vinyl was so thick. It was like the craziest thing. I was like, this is insane. And just felt so good, and it sounded so good. And then the insert was great with all the Japanese stuff. And that Japan was another thing that I really just blew my mind, just the whole culture and everything. And then I got really turned on to that because of that booklet and all the pictures inside and the Japanese writing. And it just took me to another level with Cheap Trick and just got lost in their world even further. So
one thing that's been really jumping at me the last couple of days, I was watching some videos with my stepkids, and they will never understand what Cheap Trick was to us back in the 70s. I'm 51, so you and I are about the same
right in
age
there,
wise,
right.
Yeah. But it was so weird to have Cheap Trick come along because they weren't just hard rock. There was like a punk element to them. And they had that, they were very ferocious in a lot of ways, you know, like, you know, stiff competition and stuff like that. It really was not just your standard Aerosmith or Ted Nugent or something like that. There was something going on there that I don't think the culture was really ready for. You know, I think it's strange that when people talk about punk rock, they talk about how, you know, hyped up it was and all this stuff. But I think Cheap Trick was kind of there in a way, don't you?
Oh, I totally agree. And it's just weird because as I've gotten older and listened more through the years and gone back and forth, like, I didn't catch a lot of stuff that when I was a kid in high school listening to these records, like, I didn't really connect that, the punk rock thing, until
right.
I got older. Like, there's a lot of stuff and their influences that I didn't hear in their music because I didn't know enough about music until I got older. And, like, I never really put the Who connection together and said, wow, you know, these guys, it's a lot of Who kind of things going on here. And there is
yeah.
a lot of punk rock from the 70s going on in these songs and a lot of other things, you know, besides all the Beatle influences and some other things. And so as I got older and heard other music, I heard where they were coming from and what their angle was. And I mean, I listened to last night, I was listening to Stiff Competition, the alternate take
mm-hmm.
that's on the reissue.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, that's the vocal on it, that's punk rock. Is that could have been a Sex Pistols song, only they could never play it as well. But I mean, that's got some freaking attitude, you know what I'm saying? So
absolutely.
Of course, that first album, all their stuff is just, it's got this the sneer and the whole attitude. And I just didn't consciously know it, but I just loved whatever it was. I was digging it, you know. Like I said, it was catchy and it was nasty and had hooks, and it was its own thing. It wasn't right. It wasn't Aerosmith, and it wasn't Kiss. They were their own thing, and they fit perfectly into my life, and they were just my favorite band.
Excellent. Now, there's three questions. The question's three, I will ask you. Your favorite
yes.
Cheap Trick album, your favorite Cheap Trick song, that could be a single or just a song, just one song you felt never got the love that it should have, and your least favorite Cheap Trick album.
Okay. Well, I said it already. My favorite album is Heaven Tonight. Mm-hmm. So, not being cheap trick aside, it's my favorite album of any album. So, in my life. So that's my record. When I just put that on, it just brings me to a place that I wish I was at again, and just I could listen to all those songs over and over again. I just love that record. Favorite song, you know, I like to say Surrender, because that's got everything. Like you said, it's got the hooks, it's got the attitude, it's just the perfect song. And there's things about that song as a songwriter myself, a musician, that make no sense whatsoever, because nothing even rhymes in that song. I'm sure you may know, if you listen to the lyrics and the bird, nothing rhymes. Usually in the songs, there's a rhyming scheme, and it doesn't rhyme, and it still works, and it's brilliant. But I really love, I think I may go with Such a Good Girl.
Oh. Yes.
Let me tell you something. That is my song. I always sing You're Such a Good Girl. I think literally every day, once a day, I've been singing it since it came out. That song is to me really, it may be my favorite Cheap Trick song. I love that song. Am I crazy?
No, that's an amazing song, yeah.
Yeah, it's, right. it's a great song. Like it.
Now again, I didn't go back and do my studying, but I think I get confused here. I kind of started losing interest, which bums me out. I guess it's the records after One on One, which is either what is it, The Doctor or Standing on the Edge came after One on One?
Yes, Standing
next
on
position,
the Edge.
Please, yeah, next and then Standing on the Edge,
yeah. And then Standing on the Edge, and then The Doctor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess I have to say The Doctor, because Standing on the Edge, I think there was still some good things there. The Doctor, I wouldn't even know. I'm embarrassed. I don't even know what songs are on it. I mean, you could tell me and I would know them, but yeah, I would say that one. By then I was like, I didn't like the direction and I wasn't just digging it anymore.
Well, there's a lot of people that share that opinion, you know, and it's all valid. It's all opinions and it's all good.
Right on.
So the reason that we have gathered today to join forces to talk about one of the greatest albums of all time, Cheap Trick Live at Budokan, depending on the version you have, right, BJ?
Yeah, I guess the Japanese version that Steve bought, told the story about buying, that was called Live at Budokan, right?
On the cover, is it different?
I'm not even sure. I've never seen an import. That's really great that you actually are one of the people that bought that on import. Which I've seen various numbers. I've seen 30,000, but in Mike Hayes' book, Bunny Carlos said that they sold 75,000, which was the best-selling import ever at the time. But I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know how to know exactly how many copies it sold, but it's pretty great that you are one of the people that actually went out and bought that at the time. I loved hearing that story.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm going to go find it now. I have it. It's buried in one of my bins of records. But that's interesting. I didn't know that, so I'm going to dig it out and look at it. But yes, I bought the Japanese import. And like I told you, it was really heavy. The vinyl was really heavy and very expensive. But I got one of those, so that's cool to know. I'm going to check that out. Thank you for letting me know that.
Now, Steve, when
it came out in the UK, it was on yellow vinyl, which I would love to get my hands on one of those, too.
Oh, that's cool.
And there was also the promo. Before they released it in the U.S., there was a promo called From Tokyo to You, where it only had 7 of the songs on it, and they sent it out to radio stations and stuff. Yeah, you know, since I've been reading up on this, I've been meaning to go on eBay and look and see about these different versions of it, but I haven't yet. But yeah, there's all these. There's the promo and the Japanese version and the UK version. All of those would be fun to get my hands on. So,
yeah.
Oh, that's great. And I've also got, you know, I was one of those kids that, you know, I had some posters all over my wall and pictures and ads and stuff I would cut out of magazines, and I was a total geek. And I got a bunch of Cheap Trick things like that from the era. I also worked in a record store, and so I actually have those hanging pumpkin lantern thing. I don't know the ad they had, if you ever saw that.
Right,
the
yeah.
There was a cardboard, you know, when the record came out in the States, it's a whole cardboard thing that you could hang that's for at Budokan with Japanese writers. Really cool. And I got some ads from some magazines when the record came out. That was a really cool thing, this record. And I was so excited, you know, when all of a sudden everybody started to hear about it, and I felt vindicated.
But actually, you, Tom, said something early on about Budokan as being, you know, now it's been built up in terms of its kind of prestige and what people think about it. Tell the story. I mean, in terms of when you guys first played there, it was okay. It wasn't like you were walking into the Taj Mahal.
No, it was a sumo wrestling place. Which is, you
know, and smelled accordingly.
Who doesn't like sumo wrestling, you know? But we never saw the outside. We were just shuttled in there in an armored car or something, or mail truck, I don't know. Some metal vehicle with a metal, they had no windows, sliding around in the back, and okay, you're here. Gee, that was a quick
nice
2 hours. Oh, the traffic was terrible. Thanks.
Yep. Do you guys have particular memories of that show? Was there something that stood out about that show?
Yeah. If we recorded two nights, it was April 28th and April 30th, I think it was, 1978. And if you watch the video that we did, and then you hear the album, when we did Ain't That a Shame one night, a girl jumped off the balcony onto the stage and ran up and grabbed me. I think she was aiming for Robin, but she grabbed me instead. And so the guitar solo was not in there. And so then with the other night, I don't know how I remember that because I think she broke her leg too. It was kind of cool.
Yeah. Another thing about Budokan that I remember was that just before we went on, we had a slated amount of time to play. Mm. And the Japanese are very efficient, you know, and they studied the set list and they came up to us and said, listen, you're short, you need to add another song. So we thought about it for about a second and thought, well, let's just put I Want You to Want Me in there, okay. So we decided to do that.
It
could have easily not been in the set.
It had been a hit from the studio album, but that sounded like the biggest wimp. We sounded like the Bay City Rollers on that. It was terrible. And so, but the live version was pretty cool. So then they came over the crying, all that stuff. That's not an echo machine. That's the actual audience helping us out. Yeah. And here, 35 years later, we wish they were here tonight. So you can
and a lot of people always ask me why I talk the way I do.
Well, I was just getting to
who songs.
Who told you to talk so slowly?
My manager told me.
Because we fired him very quickly, though.
He said, now, you got to speak clearly and slowly because they don't understand English very well. And so I felt like a fool when I was... But it became something iconic in a funny way. You know?
It's perfect.
Want you to want me. Yeah. You know,
I want you to want me.
I
there's one story I have about why I probably shouldn't like this album. I had become a Cheap Trick fan, and there was this girl that my uncle was dating, and she had their first album. And I was watching her kids one day, and she said, "You should really check these guys out," because she knew I was a big Beatle fan. She said, "You should really check these guys out. They're like the Beatles, but dangerous and weird." That's all I needed. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I put that album on, and I was sunk. So I went out and bought those albums. About 6 months later, this album comes out. And it is just through the roof. All of a sudden, everybody loves Cheap Trick. You guys remember what that was like. You know what I'm talking about? It was just like, oh yeah, Cheap Trick, really into them. And I had my albums at a party, and some guy who, like, probably some jock, who, like, 6 months before wouldn't have cared to even pick up this album, walked out with my entire Cheap Trick collection. And it made me angry. And I blame that on the success of Cheap Trick's Live at Budokan. Because it made their music so acceptable to the jocks and, I mean, everybody was into them for a while. It went across all the different little groups. Like, I don't know where you fit in your, like, high school culture, but I, like, kind of bridged. I was in the, like, everything from the chess club to the art nerds to the burnouts to the jocks. I kind of, like, hung out with everybody. And that was one of those great albums that seemed like everybody could hang with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, like you mentioned, I have a similar story. Like, again, when I really got into them on the Heaven Tonight record, and this is a sad story, but, you know, it's part of my character, so it helped build some character, I think.
Now, wait a second.
I loved them so much. I remember going to this girl's house when I was in high school. These were the beautiful girls, the rich girls in the rich part of town where I grew up. Uh-huh. And me and some guys went over there one night, and I remember bringing records over there to play for them, to get everybody into, and I brought Heaven Tonight, and I put it on her turntable and was blasting Surrender and trying to get these hot girls to just get into this record. And nobody, they could care less. I'm sitting like a geek going, "Listen to this record, this is the best." And they were just looking at me like, "You're an idiot. Why don't you put on some Jackson Browne or something?" You know, yeah. It was like, so nope, growing up, nobody liked Cheap Trick. Where I grew up, you know, nobody liked Aerosmith and Kiss. I was the outsider, as you said, who I hung out with. I hung out with the Greasers in my school. Uh-huh. And I was kind of in the middle. I knew all the cool kids, and I knew all the kids that weren't cool, and I was kind of just floating around in the middle. But I was kind of nerdy and goofy, and again, I love music more than most, and I liked all those bands that nobody really liked. You know, and I was always getting made fun of because I didn't like Yes and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and the Allman Brothers. So, like I said, I went to this party, and I was trying to force Cheap Trick on everybody. I realized you can't do that, but I was trying to spread the word, man, you know, and I had a few friends that, you know, that did like that, and I gravitated to those guys who eventually became musicians, and those were my friends. The people I hung out with were the people that liked the music I liked, so, which were, and again, in my high school, there weren't that many people that would go see Kiss and Aerosmith and Cheap Trick and,
right,
and those kind of bands.
But yes,
I'm sorry, but as you said, when Budokan came out and I Want You to Want Me, I was working in a record store at the time, and when that came out in the States, and the single obviously went top 10, and I would be watching it on the charts every week and hearing it on the radio, and then I just saw everybody coming into the record store buying it, and everybody started to know who they were. And I mean, I was happy, but I probably had that same feeling you guys had, you know, when you lose your babe, you know, when you, it's your little secret and you protect it. And it's all yours, they're all yours, and then all of a sudden, now everybody's claiming them, and you kind of feel way bummed out also. You're happy for their success, but you're kind of bummed out now that everybody knows and everybody wants a piece of them. And so, I don't know if that's how you felt, that's how I felt about
it. Yeah, I really can relate to that in a lot of ways, because it always seems like that happens. Like, I know that you're a Kiss fan.
Yes.
And I know that when the reunion happened, it seemed like it turned into Kiss World. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like everybody that gave us crap in high school for liking Kiss was now at the Enormo Dome or wherever you saw them. Like, I remember going, downtown Cleveland literally became Kiss World. Like, all the hot dog vendors and all the bars, they all had Kiss, like, t-shirts, and the radio stations all had, like, I remember WMMS, the buzzard, they had Kiss faces on their buzzards, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was just like, where the hell were all you people?
I was gonna say, Steve's not only a Kiss fan, his band toured with Kiss.
Absolutely.
We were fortunate to do two tours with Kiss. And just an aside to that story, being a fan and being an outsider, I told Paul Stanley, we became good friends, and I would tell him stories about my youth and his impact, and I would tell him stories. I told him a story that, I said, when I was in high school, I used to get punched and beat up and made fun of, when I'd wear my Kiss shirt, and because I loved you guys. And I go, I was a dedicated fan, and I went out on a limb for you guys and getting arguments with people, and I'm trying to like ingratiate myself to him. He says to me, "That's good. It builds character." I go, "Wow." I go, "That's your aunt? That's what you want to do?" I go, "You're not like, wow, thanks, man." He goes, "It's good. It builds character." I go, "Okay." Well, it did. It did, because it taught you to stand up for, a little bit. Go.
It really did. Your
convictions and say, you know what? I don't care what you think. This is what I'm into. I realized later I might have been a little off on some of the things I felt like. I used to get in arguments with kids when they'd say, talk about, oh, yeah, the Yes kids would go, Steve Howe's the best guitar player, or this guy. I go, yeah, I go, bullshit. Or, can I curse, by the way?
Yeah, go for it.
Sure. Oh, well, whatever, bullshit. I go, that's bullshit. I go, Ace Frehley is the best guitar player in the world. He blows all those guys away. So I might have been a little off on some of my arguments and whatever, but at the time, I stuck to my conviction. I wasn't going to have it. No one was going to tell me who I liked or what I thought was the best. So again, I was always with the underdog bands, and the guy, I never liked anything that was popular. Maybe that says something about me as well. But everybody I did like did become popular. So I guess, like you guys, we were early on stuff, and it took the rest of the world some time to catch up and to see what we all saw in these bands.
I was talking about a year and a half ago to a gentleman you might know, a fellow by the name of Ted Poley.
He's the singer for Dangerous Toys, right? Oh, no, Danger, right. Yes, of course. That's my singer. Where'd you see him?
I actually interviewed him for our Kiss show.
Oh, cool.
He was telling me that when you guys were touring with Kiss, that Paul would sing Ted Pauly to him.
Yes, that's true. We love that. That is a classic Danger thing. And to this day, we all still want it. When we're on the road or something, we'll see Ted down the hall and we need to get him over, and we start singing it and just say it. It was great. It made him feel so awesome. I mean, and you got, come on, Paul Stanley's singing your name in a song to Unholy. We were all like going, that's awesome, Ted. You got your thing. You got a Paul Stanley thing. That's great. So yes, Paul Stanley coined that, and that's the song Ted Poley to the song Unholy.
That is so cool.
And also, I was going to tell you, the Kiss thing. You said the reunion, right? About when they got back together, right? Mm-hmm. It's funny, when we did that Kiss Hot in the Shade tour back in 1990, some of the dates were one or two dates that weren't selling too well. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like a half house. And, we just looked, Paul and I would go look out sometimes before the show and go, hey, how's it looking tonight? And, and say, look, hoping for a big walk up or whatever, and it's okay. We'll see how it is. And then, and on those nights that it wasn't that good, I would just say to him, I go, all you got to do is, if you want to pack these places out, is, one day you get the other two knuckleheads, you put that makeup back on. You never have to worry about these half houses again. And he kind of looked at me and smiled. He was like, yeah, he kind of gave me like, yeah, I know. I knew that one day that was going to happen. I said, I'm just waiting to see when it's going to happen. But I know that was always in the back of their minds. Like, whatever the impetus is going to be, I don't know. But I always knew, and I said, hey, whenever you're ready, you know, if you're not happy with what's going on now, just call the other two guys, and you could always throw that makeup back on. And he knew, you know. Yeah, yeah, I think they absolutely. All, him and Gene both knew. It's just, when do we want to do this? And so, and I'm glad they did. As like, I'm sure you guys, as a fan, that was the best thing ever. So,
yeah, it was a blast. Did Danger ever tour with Cheap Trick?
Unfortunately, never did one show with those guys, and it would have been a dream. Just one show to open for those guys somewhere would be great, but it's not over yet. We're all still working, so
Did you ever meet any of them?
Oh, I've got those stories for days. Yes, I'm proud to say that I'm friends with those guys, and they consider us peers, and I hope at this point by now. But yeah, I've got Cheap Trick stories up the wazoo. I mean, I actually met my bass player and partner in Danger Danger, who formed the band with me, Bruno Ravel. I met him at a Cheap Trick concert. So there's a lot of Cheap Trick. The history and the thread there is very strong. Basically, I think quickly, my first Cheap Trick concert was at a place out here in Long Island, a place called the Calderon Theater. I'm not sure if that's the first or second one, but at this theater out in Long Island, I actually went to the show. I drove these two kids, these little kids, with me. They were Cheap Trick fans. I got them into Cheap Trick. They were younger than me, and I worked at this record store, as I mentioned, and I would play the Cheap Trick record all day in the record store. I'd play Budokan and Heaven Tonight. I'd try to turn people on to these guys. And these young kids, I was pretty much brainwashed them, going, this is what you got to listen to. This is the music. Listen to these guys. And I got them into Cheap Trick. And I said, I'm going to the concert. And their mother let me take them to the Cheap Trick concert. I was like 16. And I drove these kids who were like 13 and 10 years old to the Cheap Trick concert. And we got there early. And we went around the back of this building, and where the trucks were loading in and all this before the show, and I happened to see Robin Zander was in the back. There was a back room, and there was a door, and it was a glass door, and you could see into the backstage area, into this room. And Robin Zander was there, and he came out. He saw us three little kids standing there, and he came over to us, came out, opened the door, and just started talking to us. And it was like so cool, so sweet and so nice, and we were just so thrilled. It was like, oh my God. And we're talking to him, and he says, I don't know, I think he said something like, I'll do that song for you. I asked him to do a song or whatever, and then whatever, and then he says, I gotta go. And then we were so excited, we met Robin Zander. So we went into the show, saw the show was incredible. After the show, we ran to the back of the building again, and went to those doors that were glass doors, looking into that room, and now the room was packed, and it was like a backstage area, and it was filled with groupies and cool rock dudes and, you know, all these people. It was like an after show party going on in there. And again, I'm 16 years old with glasses, a goofy kid from high school. I got these two little kids with me, and we're standing outside the door like in a zoo, like looking in like in a display or something. And we're standing there watching all this activity going on, and then all of a sudden they walk into the room. Robin comes in, and then Rick Nielsen, and then Tom Peterson and Bunny, and they're all in there backstage, and they're hanging out with chicks and guys and all this stuff. And we're standing with our noses pressed to the glass, like, please let us in, please. And nobody paid us any attention. They're looking at us, and they're, like, smiling and laughing. And Rick, nobody cared. You know, we're all out there, Rick, let us in. Hey, come on. Nobody cared. They just, all of a sudden, Robin sees us, makes a beeline right through the crowd, and he, like, kicks the door open. And he's like, hey, guys, what's going on? And he starts talking to us. And it was wow. Just, holy crap. He just went through all these hot chicks and dudes and whatever right to us, opened the door, kicked it open, and started talking to us, how'd you like the show, blah, blah, blah. And he talked to us and was like, oh, my God, this is insane. And then I said, Robin, can we come in? He goes, I can't let you guys in here. You know, I can't. You know, we're little kids. He goes, I can't. He can't. But he goes, thank. But I go, okay, we understand. And we're like, thanks again for everything. And that was that. And I left. And I was like, wow. That made an impression on me. This is the lead singer. He saw us before the show, had a minute to talk to us. Then after the show, with all this cool stuff going on, you know, he came right through the crowd and opened that door and came out to say hi to us. And that made an impression. It's like that impression stuck with me so that, you know, when we got some fame and started doing things, I mean, I always knew that I would never turn away from a fan or anyone who wanted my time or wanted to talk to me, anything like, I would just make the time, and it would not be any effort to it. It would be effortless, and like, it wouldn't be work. That's what's important, is your fans.
Absolutely.
And just trying to connect with them, and just how important it is to talk to them, what it could mean to them, because I know what it meant to me. So by Robin doing that, I carried that with me to this day, and that's how I treat our fans. I just always have the time to speak with them. And through the years, I would go see Cheap Trick. Just, I can't go through a million, but I would, you know, go see them all the time and try to sneak backstage. And Robin would always see me, and he'd recognize me, and he'd talk to me, and then Rick would know who I was and kind of say hi. And then fast forward 15 years later, basically, I get signed to Epic Records, which is Cheap Trick's label, as you know. My A&R guy that signed us, Lenny Pizzi, who signed Cyndi Lauper and Aldo Nova and worked with Cheap Trick in Boston and all those guys back in the 70s and knew those guys, brings us to a show in L.A. We're backstage. He brings us backstage. Rick and Robin come backstage. Lenny says hello to Rick and Robin and says to them, hey guys, I just want to introduce you to my new signing. They're on the label with you guys. This is Danger Danger. This is Steve West and Bruno Ravel. And Robin looks at me and he goes, hey, he goes, I know this guy. He goes, what the fuck? So I'm like, hey, Robin. he goes, this guy's been coming to see me since, and he put, you know, puts his hand, since he was like this high, since he was a little kid. And he was blown away, and I was really thrilled that Robin, you know, still remembered me, of course, and was like, what? He goes, you're on the, he goes, and he said to me, he looked at me, he goes, I knew you would do it. He goes, you always had that look in your eye. He said to me, he goes, I knew you were going to make it. And he goes, I'm so happy. And I was like blown away again. I was like, wow. He goes, now we're label mates. And then we became friendly, and then now we're on the same label. We'd see each other on the road. And then when things started going bad for them through the years, when they weren't as popular and we started gaining popularity in certain places, they were, you know, they'd always tease me, Robin and Rick, going, hey, take us out on the road. Can you get us a gig here? Can you, you know, I'm like, what? You know, so, I mean, so we'd go see them all the time, and Rick and Robin, they bring us on stage and let us, hang out, and Rick would throw pics at us and tell the audience, hey, Danger Danger's here, you know, and it was like, it was just a thrill. I'm going, oh my God, these guys are, I know my heroes. They're talking about my band on stage. They're throwing pics at me. I mean, it was just like, I came full circle. So, and again, they're the reason, you know, and I tell them they're the reason why I do what I do with them and Kiss. It's because of them. And, you know, I owe it all to them, you know, just doing what they did. It forged, you know, made a big difference in my life. And that's why I do what I do, because of guys like that. So I'm friendly with them, yes. And again, I've got a T-shirt I could send you with the Cheap Trick logo. I don't know if you've seen that. We made, you know, which every band's made a lot of bands have made T-shirts with the Cheap Trick logo.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, they put on whatever they write on there, whatever their thing is or whatever. And so one day I made a Danger, 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 Danger shirt with all the, you know, with the logo going
so cool.
All the way down the shirt. So I wasn't sure how they were going to react to that. So I went to see them a couple of years ago, and I brought some shirts. And I said to Rick, I said, Rick, I made the shirt. I need to know if it's cool, because I wouldn't want to do anything that would upset you guys or piss you guys off. So I won't sell them, you know, if I'm just doing it because I love you guys. And he looked at it and he goes, I'm going to be mad. I said, why? He goes, well, I'm going to be mad if I don't get one of these. I said, oh man, you can have as many. I go, so we're cool. He goes, yes, you have my blessing. So I was like, wow. You know, I don't know if it was a big deal to them, but whatever. But it was just good to know that they were cool with it. So, you know, so I feel good that when we have that Cheap Trick shirt. And that shirt, people love that shirt. I got a lot of famous people wear that Danger Danger Cheap Trick shirt. And it's just cool. Again, paying homage to those guys. And any way I could spread the word and my love for those guys, I'm always happy to do that. And again, for the Hall of Fame thing as well, trying to spread the word on that. But I don't think I'm the one that's going to get them in. So.
They definitely need to be in there. You know, it's strange, as Kiss and Cheap Trick fans, you have three albums that came out and didn't do that well, and then a live album that put the band over the top. There's not many bands that have really had that happen. Cheap Trick and Kiss are two bands that share that same story, that same template, if you will. why do you think that it took those live albums to make Cheap Trick pop, or and Kiss in that same aspect?
It's weird, right? I mean, that's that story is it's the same parallel story, and I don't know what it was. Was it because of, does it go back to the Frampton record, who, you know, because, I mean, again, he's the same story. I don't know how many records he had out before Frampton Comes Alive. I know there were a few. I don't know if it was three, but I don't know what that was. It's just the record companies, was just everything aligning, just saying this is the last chance, so we got to make this happen for these guys. I'm sure by then, like they said, in the, I read the Kiss stuff and the Cheap Trick, I'm sure they were saying, what are we going to do? We got three records in and it's not happening. What's going to kickstart these guys before we drop them? Mm-hmm. And maybe, I don't know why, and maybe obviously they just threw out the live record. Maybe it's like these life preservers to see if just to keep something going. And I don't know what struck a chord or why. Obviously, the production value's not there because it's a live record. So, but maybe it's the excitement of the crowd or whatever. Maybe we all felt that. Mm-hmm. That something was going on, you know. I'm like, wait a minute. And I think the screaming, the girls, the Kiss thing, I think with the live record, with the raps and the live vibe going, wow, you felt a little more energized. It was amped up. And the Cheap Trick record, of course, I guess I never heard anything with the Japanese girls screaming.
Yeah, that was, I think, was wild.
That added something, like people, maybe that was just going, something's going on here, and that was building some tension and some excitement through this, you know, throughout the record and the songs, just making the songs feel a little more exciting. And I mean, I guess also maybe that is it, because I Want You to Want Me never stuck out, as far as, I don't know how to, you guys on that of the three records, that wasn't a song I play all the time.
No,
I rarely played I Want You. I didn't have any oomph to it or anything that made it stand out, except when you heard it on the live record. So what's the difference? Is it the sound? Maybe it's the audio. Maybe it's the crowd singing. So maybe it's the live record. You tell me what made the difference.
Well, the performance is so much better on the live version to me. There's an urgency that is there and a playfulness that's not in the studio version. And this is one of the problems with discussing this album. We have done shows, episodes, where we've discussed each one of these tracks. And I think basically if we were to take this track by track, we would just say, boy, this is a great fucking song. Boy, this is a great fucking song. Boy, this is a great fucking song. There, I just did the first three songs of Live at Budokan. So that's pretty much the whole album. You're not going to get a critical review from us in the sense that we're going to say, boy, this performance stinks, because there is not a bad song on this album.
Ken, I want to say, I think it just, because you got me thinking now, the live record, why that is, like I said, I Want You to Want Me. Maybe, you know what it is, the live record, obviously there's no piano.
Right.
The song is a lot tamer on the record, and I think maybe it's just, you're right, the performance, the live record is just nastier, it's louder, it's more aggressive, so you got just all guitars and reverb and people screaming and whatever, so I think it just took everything up a couple of notches, and maybe it just made these songs just have more of an impact. And just the arrangements also, the live, maybe some of the live arrangements, the way things changed a little bit from the records, might have been better also. As I noticed, some of the things they did live that were different were a little more exciting. You know, Rick would do a little couple, the way they played things and the sound of Tom's bass and just the whole thing. It was different and it was all amped up, and I think maybe brought some extra shine to some of those songs that just weren't popping on the earlier records.
Well, and you know, one thing that's different between Alive and At Budokan is Alive was sort of a, you get the idea, it was sort of a calculated move by the label, but At Budokan wasn't even supposed to come out in the U.S., and it was the Japanese label wanted to put out a series of albums live at Budokan, and they did the Bob Dylan one too. Mm-hmm. And so it's really just kind of a fluke that Budokan even happened, whereas Alive was, you know, really a calculated move to try to break the band.
Very good point. You're spot on. That's true. You're right, because this record wasn't, and so I changed my what I said then. And right, this wasn't an attempt to save Cheap Trick here in the States. Like, let's throw out a lot, because it wasn't slated to be released here. Mm-hmm. So, but like, But saying that, though, I guess you could say that I feel kind of partially responsible, since it was only supposed to be a Japanese release.
Yeah.
Can I feel partially responsible that it got released here, because I'm one of the people that bought the import, and they said, wait a minute, a lot of people are buying this record, maybe we should put it out here in the States? Can I take credit as one of those people?
I'm going to say that you were responsible for the tipping point. I'm the one that tipped it over.
Said one more record, we're going to release it here, and I was the guy that bought that one. Yeah, I'll take credit for that. But you're right, that's the case. You're right. It couldn't be denied. They put it out in Japan, and all of us fans, like so probably all the 100,000 fans at the time, 50,000 actually, or 100,000 in the States, I'm sure we all tried to dig it up and find it.
The band didn't really take the concept of the album as seriously as they would have if they had known what it was going to turn into. So, well, like, Bunny says that they wanted to do a double album, but they just didn't have the time to put it together. Mm-hmm. And since they thought it was just going to be a Japanese release, I guess they weren't as concerned about it. And if you think about it, it's got 10 songs, but two of the songs are Hello There and Good Night Now. So,
yeah.
And with all of the great songs that they performed at those shows that aren't on the album, I mean, it's crazy that there isn't a single song from the first album on there at all.
That is
so the
very
first
weird.
Album, which is my favorite, isn't even represented.
I think side two is a perfect side. You've got, Ain't That a Shame, going into I Want You to Want Me, right into Surrender, and right there are three of those big classic rock staples that you will hear on any classic rock station. That these are the versions that they play right here. So side two is one of those perfect sides, in my opinion.
Well, and you know what's interesting? We were talking about how the album was a fluke. Well, Ain't That a Shame being on the record is kind of a fluke too, because apparently the label actually specifically asked them to put three previously unreleased songs on there. And that's why you have Lookout and Need Your Love and Ain't That a Shame on, even though it's only a 10-song album. And Bunny says that Ain't That a Shame, they hadn't even had it in their set for like over a year. But because they just pulled it out for these Japanese shows. But, I mean, they weren't even performing that song anymore. They'd kind of dropped it from their set. And so it's funny that then it ends up on this live album, probably only because the label requested the previously unreleased songs. And then it ends up becoming one of their signature songs, just basically by a fluke, you know?
Absolutely. Hmm. Wow.
Good stuff. You're schooling me. I like these stories. I don't know the history of all this. This is great stuff. Thank you, BJ. Keep bringing it, man.
Also, the reason that Clock Strikes 10 is the last song on the record is because that was their first number one hit in Japan, so that was their encore.
The encore
was actually Ain't That a Shame into Clock Strikes 10, but Bunny said they wanted to put Ain't That a Shame up on, you know, the first song inside too.
But it's just amazing to think of how that album took off. And again, the comparison to Kiss Alive, where they had the one song that was accepted by the public. This was three great back-to-back tracks that was accepted by the public. And this album, in a way, like, I can remember the same thing that happened with this album as something that happened with two other albums that came out around that same time or within the next couple of years. And I would have to say Van Halen's first album, that was one that you heard at every party that you went to, and AC/DC's Back in Black. Those were two of the albums that, and they've all three of these albums have stood the test of time, you know what I mean?
Oh, agreed. Yeah, Van Halen record, that's a whole other story, man.
Well, so what do you guys think of the album cover for At Budokan?
Well, I'm going to go on this. I'll tell you, again, parallel with Kiss Alive, you got the book when you got Kiss Alive. With this, you got that great booklet, the fold-out, all the stuff that came with it, the OB strips and all that stuff.
Right.
It wasn't just an album. It was like you had went to the show and got all the goodies that you could have got at the concert, minus a t-shirt. That's the only thing that would have been missing from the experience. It was just an amazing cover, and they kept the, to me, it's an unbeatable package. Steve, your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, look, you got the two cool guys on the front again, and the two, you know, Bunny and Rick on the back. They kept, you know, the theme going. I loved it. It just, the package itself, the pictures, again, I was a fan of, like, I love pictures and hanging things up. The booklet was insane. The pictures inside, they look so cool. It was perfect. I loved everything about it, and just, again, like, the influence they had, I was looking, you know, since I knew I was going to be doing this, I'm looking at the CD now and reading the inner sleeve and the credits, and a lot of the pictures were taken by a man named Ko Hasebe, a famous Japanese photographer. He was the most famous Japanese photographer back in the 70s. And there was a magazine called Music Life. Mm-hmm. Are you guys familiar with that?
Oh, yeah.
That was the big Japanese rock magazine. And, you know, I used to, like, again, as a kid, I would try to get anything on Kiss and Cheap Trick. And especially, I would find I'd go to these Japanese bookstores and get magazines. They had these magazines from Japan with Cheap Trick on the cover. And I have a couple of issues of Music Life with, there's a Cheap Trick special. It's just like a 100-page book of Cheap Trick pictures and stories that's, I still have them with all Japanese writing and crazy, them in Japan and magazines with them on the cover and all these Japanese magazines and photos of them live in Japan. And it just blew my mind. And, you know, this gentleman, Ko Hasebe, was the photographer. I'd see his name on all these pictures. And then when we were fortunate enough to go to Japan for the first time, he was shooting us and on the road with us, taking our pictures and shooting the press conferences and the live shows. And, you know, I mentioned to him how, you know, that I knew who he was. And when I was a kid, I was, oh, this is the guy. He's taking all these pictures of Kiss and Cheap Trick in Japan someday, you know, and he was flattered by that. And he was happy to be taking my picture now. And I was like, my Cheap Trick dream is coming true. I'm in Japan. I'm getting pictures taken of me by the guys that took the pictures at Budokan. And, you know, eventually he was so sweet and he gave me an autograph book with his photos in it. And he wrote to me a nice thing and signed to me because he knew what a fan I was and what a fan of Cheap Trick I was. And he knew how much that meant to me. And that was cool. And we also actually, when we were in Japan, we asked the record company while we were doing photo shoots to take us to Budokan so we could see it. And we did a photo shoot in front of Budokan in the parking lot.
Wow.
Uh-huh. So we were joking, you know, I go, this may be the closest, you know, Cheap to be Danger at Budokan, but in the parking lot. So We were close. We never got to BootyCon, but we did get to take some pictures and hang out in the parking lot. So, you know, we used to joke about that. Go, well, we may not be in there, but we're in the parking lot. We're close. We're getting closer. So, but I'm sorry. That was my aside to the cover and all the artwork and all that.
Awesome.
So, again, there's so much Cheap Trick stuff that, again, when I was a kid, how much this all, I soaked this in and what it meant to me and saying, I want to do this and I hope I get to. And then years later, that a lot of this stuff was happening to me. So it meant that much more to me because, again, because of Cheap Trick, because I lived that through them when I was a teenager. And now I was experiencing it firsthand and it was blowing my mind, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just to be a part of it and being around, being on the same label in Japan and as, you know, Sony and the whole Cheap Trick. I'm like, this is crazy. I'm doing all the things they did, you know, maybe not as well or as popular, but for a minute in Japan, is, you know, we had our moment also, and it was just, it just felt great. And I could relate to the experience through these guys in my childhood, so it was even more special.
Well, I'm gonna share something kind of embarrassing to you guys. When I first heard this, you know, the album starts out, will you welcome Epic recording artist Cheap Trick? I knew that they were on Epic, but for some reason, I was thinking that it was a commentary, like, welcome the legendary Elvis Presley or something like that. So it,
iconic,
like,
right, iconic recording artist.
Yeah, like, I thought it was them, like, because they were in Japan and they're, like, telling them, you know, the Japanese audience, these guys are, like, super cool, neat. You know what I mean? Like, every once in a while, you'll, like, see. I remember, like, you watch Seinfeld, and they say there's a Japanese show called Super Fun Happy Hour or something like that. I thought it was, like, yes. Epic recording artist Cheap Trick. I thought it was a description, not the fact. For whatever stupid reason, my teenage mind.
But you know what? In hindsight, you're correct. On they're both correct. Wouldn't you
they
agree?
They are epic. They truly
but
are
yeah,
epic.
I it mean, I correct. Love that. And again, that also was the reason why when we got offered a record deal by Lenny Pizzi, at A&R guy, and he was at Epic. It was Epic Records. So that was the first label that approached Danger Danger and wanted to sign us. And my manager said, "Do you want to?" Okay, you've got one offer. Do you want to go to any other labels? Do you want to pitch this, your tape, and talk to anybody else? I was like, Epic Records, man. This is where I want to be. Cheap Trick. My favorite. I'm done. That label. I go, I don't want to look. I mean, whether that was naive or not, I was like, this is where I want to be. This is my favorite band is on Epic Records. I love Ted Nugent. Back when I was a kid, Epic Records had a lot of great records.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, I want to be on Epic. Just sign the deal. Let's go. You know, I don't care. So I wanted to be on that label. I remember they had the orange label back in the day with the logo. The whole thing was just, again, just being, just, this is great. This is my dream. I'm getting it, you know, getting the whole thing, you know. Epic Records, Cheap Trick again. And again, just quick, with the Cheap Trick, the Japan thing again. Again, I would get those Music Life magazines from Japan with them on. Do you guys have any of those by any chance? Have you ever seen them?
Yes, no, I've seen them. Yeah, they're really cool.
They are so neat. And the way the Japanese did it, the pictures are great, the colors, the Japanese writing. And again, like, I bought those and I have a bunch of them and spent a lot of money getting them, you know, as a kid, going, I got to get these things. And then again, for us, a proud moment, again, for me, was to be when we were on the cover of Music Life magazine. I was like, this is insane. And again, I would always mention that Cheap Trick's my favorite band. In Japan, everybody knew, and it was in all my bios. And they'd always bring up Cheap Trick to us when we were in Japan, you know, and say, oh, your favorite band is Cheap Trick. And a lot of kids were starting to get into Cheap Trick. They were saying that they didn't know who they were because of us at the time, because they were younger, our fan. You know, this is, again, a decade later, so kids were like going, writing me saying, oh, you say your favorite band's Cheap Trick. I went out and got there. I really liked them. So I was getting a lot of letters from fans and people saying, I got into Cheap Trick because of you, because you say you like them and they're your favorite band. So that made me happy as well. And then jumping ahead again, as you know, there's a Cheap Trick at Budokan too. Another great moment for me. I mean, I'm sorry, this is all about me and Cheap Trick. I guess I'm in the right place, though, right?
Absolutely.
Right, Ken? BG,
yep.
I guess.
Yeah, that's great.
I could vent all my cheap street. But like, so again, when we were getting popular in Japan and we were, you know, we were doing really well over there and selling a lot of records and doing all the stuff. And again, I was spewing how much I love Cheap Trick in every interview and blah, blah, blah. So a Japanese fan told me that they got, when they got the Japanese release of Cheap Trick at Budokan 2 years later, that there's Japanese liner notes inside the CD. You know, as they do in Japan, they have the English booklet, and then they have a booklet in Japanese with English lyrics and sometimes part Japanese lyrics, and then a whole explanation and stories in Japanese. So there's an interview with Rick Nielsen in the Budokan 2 thing, and they're asking him about Budokan, you know, and his reminiscences about it and his thoughts and the whole thing and the experience about Budokan and the impact and et cetera. And this fan wrote me and sent me the insert and said, Rick Nielsen mentions in this in the insert, he's talking about Danger Danger, saying that it's like, you know, Danger Danger's favorite album and how we're fans of the band. And he, so I'm like, wow, Rick Nielsen's mentioning Danger Danger in Budokan, in an interview about Budokan and the Budokan 2 CD, how we love Cheap Trick and Budokan's one of our favorite records.
That is awesome.
So I was like, he's giving me credence. I'm like, is that he's got to say Danger, you know? I was like, this is insane. So again, just another great moment for me and for the band of going, just, you know, just spreading the love around and letting people know how much we love them. And I'm glad that he acknowledged and the band acknowledged our love for them and what they meant to us, and just trying to get a new generation into them and just to keep spreading it. So, okay, and that's that. That's my Budokan 2 story.
That is so cool. You know, sometimes people say that the song sounds so much better, the live version. I'm going to ask you guys, are there any songs that you feel the album versions are better than the live versions on this one? Or are these the definitive versions, BJ? Like, do you think that the live versions are the definitive versions, or what?
No, if I was going to listen to Come On, Come On or Big Eyes, I would go to the In Color version, probably. Okay. If I just wanted to listen to a specific song and wasn't just going to put the whole Budokan album on, you know. But obviously, to me, the great thing about Budokan is Lookout, because it's such an amazing song, and obviously it wasn't released at the time. And then when they did put it as a bonus track on the first album, it's kind of unfinished. Like, there aren't any harmony vocals or anything on it, so...
Right.
I mean, the ultimate version of that song is definitely the Budokan version. I love that song.
This is a brand new one. It starts with Mr. Bunny Carlos.
Yeah, I think I half and half as I'm thinking about it. Again, to me, sonically, I think the second record, In Color, didn't hold up. again, to me, my first Cheap Trick album was Heaven Tonight, and sonically it was sounded amazing. Everything, the sound of it, the songs were, blew my mind and really hold up still today. And then I went from there to the first album, which was a whole different animal and sounds amazing. And then In Color was the third record I got, and it's kind of lies in between somewhere. It's not popping as much. It's kind of just there. And I mean, the songs are great, but some of them stand out more than others. And I think it's just because of the way they were recorded. So like, I have to think that, like, to me, those songs on the live record pop more to me. They have more of an oomph. So I like them on the live record. Need Your Love to me on the live record is the best version for me. Just the way, just the whole vibe, the start, just the feel, building up, slowing down, the whole thing live, I really feel the tension, and that's one of my favorite songs, so definitely the live version. And I Want You to Want Me, obviously, is to me, is way better than the recorded version. It's just got more, it's just so much more alive, so. Yeah, I think that, I think for a live record, that's pretty rare to have the live versions shine more, you know, brightly, more brightly than the recorded versions. Because usually live records just, it's just sounds like nonsense, you know, just a lot of noise.
Well, when you think of Kiss Alive, the same thing, again, the parallel is there, that to me, a lot of those songs on that album are the definitive versions of those songs. Like Deuce, for example, in the studio, it's still a great song with some boogie to it, but it is not as strong as it is on Alive. So I think that speaks something to both the bands Kiss and Cheap Trick. And it also points out how important touring is to a band and what a live act can bring to not only the stage, but to the vinyl.
Oh, agreed. And I agree with you as well, as by playing, when you're recording a record, sometimes you don't really play these songs a lot. You write them, you rehearse them, and you cut them. So you might, some of the songs you might not have performed a lot. Some you might have for years. Some maybe we just wrote it, we rehearsed it for a couple of days, and we lay it down. So, like you said, by touring these songs for gig after gig and years, you know, you start getting into a groove, and you actually can make the song better, the feel of it better, because you, it's like become second nature. You feel things that you didn't originally, like on the record, going, man, maybe I should have done this, maybe I should have done that. You feel, you know, you get to, you know, tweak things a little bit, and which Cheap Trick did a lot. And I think for the most part, they did that with a lot of songs. They made them better by adding little guitar parts, Rick doing certain different things, the way Bunny played certain fills. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's true. By playing them, you also get better at them. And you could amp them up again and make them sound better and, like, exaggerate certain parts where maybe on the record, hey, let's bring this part up a little louder here live, and let's slow this part down a little bit where maybe, you know, you couldn't do that on the record. So it definitely adds a different vibe to it live.
Absolutely. Now, BJ, since we're not doing the track by track per se, we do know that there are many different versions, and Steve has alluded to Budokan Part 2. Which version would you recommend that a new Cheap Trick fan get? Now, if obviously, if you're a die-hard Cheap Trick fan, all of them is the answer. You want to get every version out there, because whether it be the one with the DVD or, you know, however it is, what would you recommend to somebody who really wants to get the deal of Budokan and what an important album is? What would you recommend?
Well, for that, probably just the original. Well, but what's interesting about it is the 10-song Budokan album was compiled from three different shows, one of them in Osaka. And I've read that half the album, I don't know which songs, but it said half the album is from the Osaka show, which wasn't even at Budokan, right? Mm. And then there were two shows. I think the Osaka show was April 27th, 78, and then the Budokan shows were the 28th and the 30th. And so the one that's called the Complete Concert is, I guess that's the full show from April 30th, and that's also what's on that box set. Mm. So, you know, to get, you know, the versions, the Budokan versions are only on the original album. Then you can get the Budokan 2, you know, they played 19 songs at the show at the Budokan. The set was 19 songs, so the Budokan 2, they filled it with some songs from when they played at Budokan in 79. I think there's like three songs of Budokan 2 that were from the next year. I don't know. You know, to me, the one that's in the box set where you just get the full concert, like unaltered, mm-hmm. from April 30th, I mean, that's really cool to have that.
Plus, you get the DVD.
Yeah, there's a that show was actually on Japanese TV back then. They filmed it for Japanese TV.
Wow.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to have that bootleg. I had on VHS. Somebody got for me a long time ago. It was like, oh my god, I got the Cheap Trick concert and all the. Because again, Japan's great. Like, it's a whole different thing. They filmed us there live, and they broadcast it on TV there. So what they do. Right. And, I mean, that doesn't happen here in the States.
No.
You know? So, I mean, we had a whole concert in Japan on TV there, and that's all over YouTube, that Japanese concert for us. So that's our small little Budokan. But, yeah, it's nice to have those memories. The Japanese did, you know, kept a lot of good music alive and a lot of good shows. I'm glad they do stuff like that over there. Look how much stuff we have because of that, you know, so that's great.
Well, you know, it's hard to talk about an album that we've discussed all the tracks on the other shows, but this album has such a unique place in all of our collective Cheap Trick loving hearts, and it's just so amazing that we have this document of our time. And one of the things that I really want to stress, that if you have never taken the time to spend with this album, go out and try and find a vinyl copy of this. Turn off your cell phone, turn off the TV, put some headphones on, and just look at all that stuff. Try to go back with us, back in time to those days when you could just lose yourself in an album. You will appreciate this album if you give it a chance in a way that you never have before. This to me is the one album that I'd almost hand any buddy who really needs to know about Cheap Trick. It pretty much says everything that you need to know about them.
The audience in Japan, it was like very polite, and you know, it was so strange because they clapped and stopped because they wanted to hear you talk.
Each one of those people bought a ticket just to see you. There was no opening act. I mean, it was just you. And for them to have that kind of response to us, it really was overwhelming.
We were $1 million in the hole, and we didn't have a hit record. And the next tour, we kind of felt like the Beatles, because then we had some hit records, and we knew what was going on.
It had a big impact on our career, yes. So without that, I don't know what would have happened. We didn't realize anything that was life-changing. It just was some, it seemed like some odd event that we were witnessing. Like, wow, well, it really was like it wasn't even happening to us. It's like, wow, this is really interesting, you know. No one will ever believe this at home, so. And they didn't.
According to Bunny, it's 98% unaltered. So yeah. It's a real live album. Woo! More than most, you know?
I like that. I mean, that says a lot. I mean, as you know, compared to some of the other live albums out there.
Absolutely. Well, and as we know, when you have Robin Zander as your singer, you know, you don't have to worry about touching up the vocals.
Right, absolutely.
The greatest singer in rock, as I say, to my ears, again, like you said, it's all subjective. He is the ultimate. And I mean, maybe he is the ultimate, he should be to everybody, but to me, I'm sure you agree, the greatest pipes. I never heard that guy. I've been at see them 50 times. That guy is screaming at the top of his lungs. I've never heard him lose his voice. I never heard him miss a note. I mean, he is the Iron Man of rock and roll. So kudos to Robin. And he always says to me, when I see him, that he doesn't understand why I love him so much and why he goes, well, I don't get it. What are you? I go, you don't get it, man. I go, he just is so like humble about it. I said, you are the greatest singer in rock to me. You are my hero, and stop trying to fight it. So,
and for some perspective of where Cheap Trick were after this album, it was the number 13 best selling album for the entire year of 1979. And
wow.
They were voted number one live act in Cream magazine in 1979 and number one tour. So, I mean, right after this album, they were a huge deal.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, man. And then just into Dream Police and boom. And then I went to see them at Madison Square Garden. I mean, they went right to the top, man. A couple of years, they were killing it.
Absolutely.
So, and well-deserved.
And well-deserved, definitely. So take some time, listen to this album, get lost in this album. Tell us your favorite songs off this album. Let us know on the Facebook group. We're going to post this, so put it in the thread there. And let us know your favorite moments off this iconic, classic album. And with that, I'd like to thank Steve for being on the show. Anything for Danger Danger coming up? Anything we can be on the lookout for?
Look out. yes. We're just starting to get our year together. We had a busy year last year. So we've got a show in Denver for any of your Denver fans in May. May 23rd, we'll be in Denver. And then we're headlining a festival in Stockholm, Sweden in July. So we've got two shows. That's our world tour for 2015. Denver and Stockholm, Sweden.
Wow.
And I'm hoping to fill in the blanks between those two shows as the new year starts coming together. So I'm sure we'll have more dates to announce. So check us out on our website or Facebook, and hopefully we'll be doing some Cheap Trick songs on the road as well, as we like to once in a while throw into our set. So, all you Cheap Trick fans, come see us. There's a lot of Cheap Trick in our music. It's subtle, it's hidden, it's in there, and if you're a real fan of Cheap Trick, you might find it. But I'm proud. Like, just as an aside, Ken, whenever I'm stuck on a song lyrically or a musical part and we need something, mm-hmm. I just steal something from those guys and throw it in there. And I've told Rick that, and he's obviously done the same. As we know, if you listen to a lot of their records, there's a lot of borrowing from, which I never learned, you know, until I got into them more and started learning about the Move and hearing some other Beatles stuff and whatever, just, you know, picking little choice tidbits. And it's really nice just to show, you know, where you come from and your influences. So I think it's important to bring those threads into your own work also, and pay homage to that, and just have that as part of your spirit and as part of your music in there. So it's kind of coming out to the world. And so I think it's all good, and it's all fair game.
Excellent.
If it's done in good, you know, with goodwill and with love. And again, my favorite band, and I love those guys. And again, I can't profess it enough, as I'm sure you guys can as well.
All righty. Well, with that, we will say good night now, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks so much for having me. Thanks, BJ. It was a real honor, and I'm sorry for all my rambling. I get hyped up when I talk about Cheap Trick, so just edit out all the nonsense and make me sound good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot for doing this with us. It was great.
Thank you guys for having me. And anytime you need me, I'll be here to talk about my favorite band in the world and yours as well.
All righty.
Awesome.
We will see you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, guys. Be
all
good.
Right.
And that's our show. Trick Chat is an online nonprofit audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to Cheap Trick or any of their members, past or present. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes to buy it. If you enjoyed this show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying keep cheap tricking.
Can I curse, by the way?
Yeah, go for it. Sure. There are a lot of pictures that someone took the time to upload of elephants fucking. 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 Elephants fucking.